Thank you all for being patient while we're waiting for the speakers. As some of you know, our speaker was doing another gig in a room just across the corridor, so we should allow him a bit of a couple of minutes.
Speed dating.
Speed dating, yes, yes, speed presenting. I think, you know, most people in the audience know our guest today, Professor Ilias Papaioannou, is Professor of Economics at LBS, the London Business School, and also co-director of the Wheeler Institute for Business and Development. He is a CPR fellow, also managing co-editor of the Review of Economic Studies, one of the top journals in economics, and I'm pleased to say also, prospectively, also a recent associate of the Hellenic Observatory. Very nice. He has an LLB from the Law School of the University of Athens, a Master's in Public Administration from Columbia University, and a PhD in Economics from the London Business School. After completing his PhD, he worked at the European Central Bank, and from 2007 to 2012, he was Assistant Professor at Dartmouth College in the US. Also has been visiting assistant professor in Harvard in the economics department and the Department of Economics of MIT, visiting professor. His research covers international finance, but mainly political economy, economic history, institutions, and growth and economic development. And he has published widely in some of the top journals in economics and in finance, and on finance, PJE, Review of Economic Studies, American Economic Review, Journal of Political Economy, and others. But he's not going to talk to us about the long term development of Africa and institutions there. That was the previous hour. He's going to talk to us about a large project that he's doing, as you will tell us, Mr. Michalopoulos, and others on refugees from Anatolia in Greece. A very big centennial assessment. If you want to tweet on the event, the hashtag always is hashtag. LSE Greece, and the event is being recorded and will be available as a podcast. Hopefully, there's no technical problems. Ilias has agreed to put all the 500 slides of the presentation into more or less 45 minutes, so that we have plenty of time for a discussion at the second part of the seminar. But if you have any immediate, more kind of practical, technical questions, feel free, I think, to interrupt and ask your question. Ilya, the floor.
Thank you, Vasily, very much. Thank you all for coming here. It's a real pleasure to come back to LSE, where I took some interesting, very technically demanding courses earlier on. Can I stand up, or do you want me to
sit? Yes.
Okay, thanks.
I'll see you.
So, this is joint work with Stelios at Brown, and our motivation for that, in some sense, is twofold, but given that we are in a Greek audience, it mostly comes because we wanted to apply insights of recent research in economic history into a topical issue for Greece, and I would say one of the most topical issues for the modern Greek state since its establishment in the late 1820s has been the influx of, roughly speaking, 1.5 million refugees from Anatolia. I will use Anatolia as an amalgam of Pontus, Eastern Thrace, Cappadocia, Izmir, but also from contemporary Bulgaria, contemporary Romania, even contemporary Odessa, Ukraine, and the Caucasus region, that through the population exchange deal of Eleftherios Venizelos and the Turkish side in 1823, effectively kind of came to Greece, roughly speaking, 100 years ago. Now we have, we are super privileged to work with some great people here. Actually, if anything, they are way, way better than us. Sihun Sakali being one. Stelios Paragiannis, Eli Mourad, and Nikos Benos, who have been working on the economic side, and with Vasilis Lobothetis, who have been working more on the political kind of imprints of refugee flows, and with Anastasis Stavrakoudis and his team at Jan and I, we have been privileged to work with something like 60 research assistants who have been helping us digitize the data that you will see. I think we are happy to report now, and very generous support that we received mainly from the NSF and the Hellenic Bank Association and London Business School. We are here, and I can present with reasonable confidence some preliminary evidence of this kind of research that tries to do effectively three things. Provide new data for Greek scholars, but also for the Greek people about a deeply emotional part of modern Greek history. Second, to assess the effect of the influx of refugees in the economy, and we will be looking at education, so-called structural transformations of employment in agriculture versus manufacturing and services, and notes about migration, internal and external. This would be the economics component. Then we will look at politics, so what are the voting preferences of refugees, and more generally, what can we say about their political ideology. And thirdly, we will try to assess the cultural impact of refugees, and as a side result of this project, we will provide a topic analysis based on machine learning techniques of the universe of Greek songs, that of course can be used not only for this particular kind of application, but for many others. Now, obviously, this is a topic that it's very important for Greek identity, but it's quite important nowadays where we are seeing an influx of refugees. Actually, before my presentation, I keep updating this number from the United Nations Commission for the Refugees, and it keeps rising and rising. As of earlier today, there were a kind of 131 forcibly displaced kind of people in the world, and given the chaos and the disaster in Ukraine, this is not anymore an issue that you know touches mainly Africa, but it has also come to Europe. Of course, we had a previous kind of influx of refugees in Europe in 2015. Of course, as I mentioned, this comes mostly from our interest in this defining moment of recent Greek history. Of course, as many of you here, many friends here, we know we had to read these books, sometime in, I guess, in high school or something, and many others. And I think it's fair to say that this kind of books and many others have been defining features of Greek identity. Perhaps the most prominent Greek poet, actually the second most prominent, I think the most prominent is Konstantinos Kavafis, George Seferis was coming from Izmir, of course George Theotokas with massive influence on the political ideology of the continent. You can look at sports, you can look at civic organizations and also in art. Actually, an interesting point, in case you want to team up for recent work, it seems that the influx of refugees was also quite important in the United States. So there was a very interesting, there's still an ongoing very interesting exhibition at Gennadios, where Greek songs from Asia Minor is among the top 10 in production and popularity in the United States in the 20s and the 30s. So it's also kind of very interesting from this viewpoint. And our approach is to try to move beyond case studies. I want to be here and quite sincere. I have many of the evils of economists, but I don't want this to be seen as, economists trying to monopolize everything. There has been a lot of anecdotal work, a lot of political science research, a lot of historical research, not to say the beautiful narratives of Sotiriou and Venezis and Theotokas and many others, also of Psathas. We want to bring kind of economic tools and see, what are the lessons that we can draw now that we are kind of 100 years post this very traumatic kind of event. Let me skip the literature, which is not particularly relevant at this stage. Now, I presume that this audience is well familiar with the history. I presume also that we might support different parties, so there may be a different interpretation of history here also. But without going into the nitty-gritty and why these things happen, for various reasons, Greece, although initially kind of is part of the winning side of the Great War, soon or subsequently 3 years down the road, Greece loses in the Greco-Turkish kind of war, and this population exchange between Venizelos and the Kemalists in Turkey gets put in a paper initially in late January 1923, and then it's incorporated in the Lausanne Treaty, which, as you know, is still the main piece of a deal between the Turkish and the Greek kind of Cyprus. Now, turning now more into what we will be doing, we have roughly 1.5 million people fleeing Anatolia. Again, Anatolia will be the five main regions I mentioned before, and something like 600,000 Muslims, mainly residing in Macedonia, Western Thrace, to a lesser extent in other parts of Greece, kind of following the reverse route and going from contemporary Greece into Turkey. So, when the refugees arrive in Greece, they are officially kind of split into urban and rural. So urban would be those communities that settled, for example, in Nea Smyrni or in Neos Kosmos or in Nea Erythrea, and then you would have, and those communities would not get land, and then you would have what officially was classified as rural refugees that to a great extent settled in Macedonia in places where the Muslims kind of left, and there they got land back. Now, important, I want to stress something that I must admit I didn't much know. The effort of the Refugee Settlement Commission, if I was to give one suggestion for further reading, is reading about this commission. I don't know whether, I learned relatively recently about that. It's supposed to be the best run public agency in the history of Greece. Its leader, Henry Morgenthau, is one of the most remarkable persons I've ever read the story. It's like the more I read about him, the more amazed I am. He was the last, not the last, he was one of the last ambassadors of the United States in the Great Pile, in the Ottoman Empire, from an extremely wealthy kind of family. And he was assigned as the head of the, in Greek, Epitropia Apokatastasis Prosphigon, the Greek, the Refugee Settlement Commission. Actually, a British was the deputy governor, effectively, and there were two members assigned by the Greek side. And I strongly recommend you can find this online. I was sent to Athens. It's kind of super interesting because you have a very enlightened and very well-cultivated American describing Greece at the time. As a side remark, his son, with exactly the same name, Henry Morgenthau, was the secretary for the Treasury in the United States during the FDR period. So his son is also a quite important figure in US policy. So for the project that will focus on economics, so we will look on both sides, both on the rural refugees and the urban refugees. Now we will look at the rural refugees for an analysis of the economic effects of the population exchange, and then we will look at urban refugees when we will try to assess the political and the cultural imprint. In general, you should think that most of the rural refugees, again rural based on what they were doing in Greece, were also kind farmers and herders where they came from, and most of the people that settled in big cities were also coming from cities. By no means one-to-one, but as a first rule of thumb, what they were doing in Greece kind of correlates with what they were doing in Anatolia before there. Now for this project, with the help of the big team of Thanasis Stavrakoudis at the University of Ioannina, and now we digitized a lot of data, so which were kind of useful for various components of the project, and now in this website, Anatolia Imprints, we have already made and we will continue updating the data that you can all use. Now, this is the first and sadly the only Greek national census that explicitly asked residents of Greece whether they are refugees or not. It is in 1928. Now, importantly, in this census, we have roughly 1.2 million refugees. Now, why do I say most likely there were 1.5? There is a significant amount of refugees, a bit like Ilia Kazan, where they come to Greece and then subsequently they move to the United States or elsewhere. Mortality rates were very high during this time, and you know there is a time lapse between 1920 up to 1928. Plus, many refugees, like the family of George Seyferis, actually came before that. And according to the Lausanne Treaty, a refugee was whoever was forcefully displaced after the beginning of the Great War. So this is a distribution of refugees. As you see, most of them go to Macedonia, where the departing Muslims leave their villages and their land. Many go to Western France. What I didn't know, which is actually quite of interesting, is that Eastern France, before the beginning of World War I, had bigger Greek populations as compared to Western France. So actually, one of the problems of Venizelos is how on earth he will try to make a claim to Eastern France without having the Western France. So many people in France actually effectively come from Eastern France, especially when they are scared that Kemal's troops will attack them. Then we have some big communities, of course, in Athens that you cannot see very well, and those would be mainly coming from the area of Ionia and in Izmir. And then we have many people from Pontus and Cappadocia that would be mostly settling in Macedonia. As you can immediately see, and this is actually quite fascinating for another kind of paper, in the old Greece where I come from, just because they were perhaps royalists, you know, they were not particularly welcoming the refugees. Now, the second bit of data we got was now, let's try to move to the urban settlers. So then we managed to detect in the League of Nations the various maps that the commission led by Morgenthau kind of compiled. So this would be, you know, in Eritrea, this would be like the area in the original map, and this would be the contemporary map that we create out there. Now, there are a couple of other interesting pieces of data. So the data I showed you before is from the census. However, this commission, EAP, also created their own kind of informal census. Informal census was not part of the Greek census in 24 and 25. So they were recording the families. So here we have information about the family head of both urban and rural refugees. And the neat thing of those kind of catalogs, of course, we don't have everybody, we just have the household heads, is we also know where they come from. So we have kind of a bilateral structure. So for example, this is like a village, I presume close to Agrinio. You know that in this village, people from these places, as you can see, mostly from Pontus, kind of settled here. Reversely, you can pick a place, Kiziki, for example, in Asia Minor, and you can see where people from Kiziki kind of. This is the distribution of place of origin for the refugees that we have in our data. Again, mostly from Eastern Thrace, Pontus, Cappadocia, and the areas surrounding Aspen. From the electoral record of Athens of 1924, so this is when the refugees, of course, come, they get the political rights, they are adamant supporters of Venizelos, or if you prefer, adamant opponents of the royal family. And the nice thing there is, for the only time, we have also the professions and the occupations. Of course, those would be the refugees only in Attica, so not necessarily fully representative. So we can see, for example, that most of them are doing peri-agriculture, so they would be working in Markopoulos or close to the Venizelos airport in agriculture, or they would be much more likely to be small kind of traders or blue-collar kind of workers, not, of course, civil servants or lawyers or kind of officers. And we also have the names, so we can assign some names like Aisanoglu as being like a name that is prototypical of a refugee in Attica, which we call, we don't have that many from Pontus, and of course whatever, Patelusis or Pateli would be like a name reflecting refugees. Now, Stelios had this very bright idea. We managed to get data from EVA, so about small businesses today, in 2019 or 2021. And actually, if you do kind of a similarity analysis, you see that the minute you go, let's say, from Nea Erythrea to the old refugee neighborhoods of Nea Erythrea, the likelihood that the guy who sells souvlaki or the guy who runs the cafeteria has like a name like Yannis Ioannidis, you know, my dear friend, is kind of way more similar. So there is some inertia on where refugees used to be, used to settle 100 years ago, and where they live in some sense. Other set of data that we digitized, and we're doing more work given our since I guess we don't get involved in politics directly, we studied it. Anyway, so I've been digitizing a lot of electoral data. We did it for Sergi too. I'll show you some election results. The big trouble there is it took a lot of time. Is that although we have the data at the electoral district, of course we don't know where the electoral district was. At the time, actually, I still remember that in the front page of the newspapers you will have the electoral district, so the team in Ioannina went over and meticulously recorded the data. So this would be the data. Trying to keep up with the time. Now, first kind of work with Sehun, Ellie, Nikos, and Stavros, we kind of try to look at the economic effects of the refugees. Now, how are we going to approach this issue? First of all, we will look at rural refugees, or refugees who settled in the countryside and got land, all of them got land. And effectively what we will do is we will try to find some villages that are exclusively or predominantly refugees. So this would be these two villages here, Laka, for example. And then we will try to match effectively this village with some nearby kind of villages where the majority or overwhelmingly or exclusively they were of natives. The idea being you want to neutralize kind of the role of geography or ecology and perhaps, you know, the role of local administrators at the eparchia or at the nomo kind of level and compare economic outcomes in this village, for example, Lakas, compared to the nearby village, with a small bandwidth of 15 kilometers and kind of larger one with 25. Now, the reason why we have to do that is because although the Greek state asked whether you were a refugee or not in 1928, they stopped asking this question subsequently, so we cannot conduct the analysis for Konstantinos Matakos and Manolis Galanianos and Ilias Papaioannou. We have to do it at kind of the village. So, effectively, we will be comparing before, after, the evolution in education, in human capital, in employment, in manufacturing and services as compared to the traditional agricultural sector in those villages to the pure controlled kind of village. Let me just show you some results. So, result number...
Can I ask something about the data? Sorry, Dan.
Please.
So in 1928, you have individual names, which you know whether the refugees are or not? No.
For the census of 1928, I have across 11,000 settlements.
I see.
The share of men and women refugee as compared to total population of these two villages, I have it only separately for men and women. So this is what prevents me. The individual catalogs I showed you before, I have them at one snapshot in time in 1924-1926. So, result number one. the level of education of refugees settling in the countryside was, if anything, somewhat lower than the one of comparable native Greeks. Of course, I will use the term natives kind of in abusive kind of. So, this would be mean years of school. Now let me show you primary school completion, because this is the time when effectively schooling meant primary school. You can see an evident gap between the schooling, the completion rate of primary school, of the Dimotiko, for the refugees settling in the countryside as compared to here. Also, and actually for me it was very big news, even if one was to look at the aggregate statistics of 1928 census, the same would apply even if you were to look at the urban refugees. So I always had this presumption, again thinking about Seferis, or I went to Athens College, which was established to a great extent by refugees. You always, perhaps you might get an idea that, oh, you know, the refugees were like those super well-educated writers or famous industrialists. Actually, they are the exception rather than the rule. The refugees, even the refugees settling in the big cities, have lower levels of completed primary as compared to the natives in the three big cities. And what you can see here very cleanly and succinctly, I think, just look at the descriptive patterns, is that they catch up very quickly. Now, if you were to fast forward and now look at junior high school completion, now the difference in different kind of estimates shows that, look, you have a spike of completed primary, and then this spike kind of disappears. And the reason why it disappears is by the time you are in 1967, 1976, so I'm sadly sad to report that I'm in this category, although close to 76, 67. Well, almost all Greeks have completed primary schooling, but here comes the neat result. If you now were to look at gymnasium, now you see that in the beginning there are no differences, but now refugee villages start doing better. And then if you want to put this in a regression, you can see it very clearly. So this would be the first cohort, this would be the second, and this would be something like the third. So initially, you have a spike of primary education, which kind of dies out as primary education completion in Greece reaches 100. Then initially a small spike in secondary education, which of course accelerates over time. And then over time, you see also a spike of tertiary education. So this would be if you were to do everything together. So here in 2011, we have a very big sample, 25% of the population. Of course, in the census of 2011, we cannot go back in time because we wouldn't have people who were born in 1880. But you can clearly see that the two sets of villages and small towns, refugee and native, kind of are in the same trajectory path. Recall before there were big differences. So that means that you have convergence, and if anything, refugees kind of achieve higher levels of education, which is what the regression kind of shows. So the first kind of result I want to communicate is that refugees start with a lower level of education. Very quickly they catch up. A conjecture I have, to be driven also by my prior, is that perhaps the reforms of Venizelos, initially with Gondikas and subsequently with Papandreou in the late 20s, of expanding the 3,000 schools kind of helps. We want to test this more formally. And then over time, if anything, refugee towns and villages, and here if we were to look all refugees, all those who were born in a refugee village as compared to a nearby native village, kind of have a higher level of education. Which is kind of interesting from a non-Greek viewpoint also, because it provides compelling evidence for the so-called uprootedness hypothesis, an idea that has been put forward a lot for Jewish communities. And there's some exciting recent work by economists. They also have a paper in Mozambique documenting similar patterns. That refugees are forcibly displaced is because they are stolen from the physical capital. Physical capital in this setting would be perhaps a house that they might have in Izmir, or perhaps a farm that they might have in Pontus, or some goats and sheep that they would have. It's kind of stolen, and therefore, endogenously, they kind of invest in human capital that cannot be exploited. Now, the second kind of evidence that is one of the beauty of the census data, that we can do a super thorough heterogeneity analysis. So see, is the effect larger when we look at refugees from Thrace, from Pontus, from Cappadocia? Actually, with Cappadocia, it's kind of smaller. We believe this is because the Cappadocians were speaking this peculiar kind of, so the language was not exactly the same as with the natives. So perhaps this would be part of the story, but we can do a very thorough kind of heterogeneity analysis. Now, second kind of result.
All this comes from a comparison of what you nominate as the future villages.
Correct.
There's no kind of test for parallel trends here.
Well, the only test for parallel trends I can show you is that before they were in a different path. So that's the only thing I can say, that before there were a gap and then they kind of moved together.
Yeah. Because in part, I mean, you know, you match them by distance, but of course we know that, you know, you can have a Kefalochori and a small village closer to each other. It's not very much characteristics.
I skipped a lot of balancedness tests, saying that population densities are kind of comparable and many kind of observable characteristics are kind of similar in refugee and non-refugee.
That's a question. So the refugees from Pontus, it's a particular group because some of them at least had double immigration. So in a sense, many of them went to Russia and then they came back to Greece.
Caucasus and exactly. Odessa.
So most probably there is an effect there because the families were investing quite a lot on the education of the younger ones, given that they had like a series of necessary immigration. So. So this can be explored if you split like the,
yeah, it's kind of
the years that they arrived to Greece. Yeah, exactly.
Well, by 1923-24, everybody, recall this is like, they had to return very quickly.
But this is 1971, right? So the,
correct.
So the, here, the last big wave was 1965 from Pontos. So from Russia.
And there were people arriving well after 25.
Yeah, and also there was another wave in the 90s, but this was quite different because they were quite homogenized.
But let me say here, it's not that the census people record when the movement happened.
Yeah, right.
But that's a very good point. I could explore it.
There's also from Pontus in Trapezon, the people from over there, because where I come from, they were very proud of the Frontisterio, of the
exactly.
famous school.
Yeah, there was a university-like structure already.
Yes, it was a big
so education was a big thing.
It was a big thing, education.
Okay. And Anatolia, actually, Anatolia College in Saloniki.
Yes. Do you have information about the language they spoke?
We can only infer it from what we've been reading, that the Cappadocians were not speaking. We don't have Karamanlidic or not, for example.
Because many were Turkish speakers.
Yeah,
many
exactly.
spoke different dialects.
Many. I mean, people say it's around 5-8%.
The cinemas in Thessaloniki had Turkish subtitles in movies. So people could read, follow the plot. They couldn't.
Let me move on, and I can take more, and try to be on time. So, how about, and I think it was a brief
period,
what about what they were doing? And again, you see some form of a parallel trend before, but then clearly over time, refugee villages, and recall, these are refugee villages, we're not talking now about refugees in the big cities, are kind of moved outside agriculture, this is what the definitive effectively capture, into manufacturing, so you see here the big step. I don't have the results. This reflects both textile and over time more capital intensive manufacturing and over time over to services. So, and recall, these are refugees that got land. So, I'm comparing again refugee people who were born in a refugee village and people who were born in a nearby native village. And I know that both of them had pieces of land. Of course, one can always make the point that, you know, the land for the natives were kind of larger, although at least my reading of the history is not definitive. And again, one now can go to 2011, so I cannot have a pre, but here I'm also studying someone who lives in Athens, and I compare him, so let me show you the regression, which will be the best one. So here I'm looking in Athens, I'm taking two individuals that live in the same in the same city, let's say in Kifisia. The one was born in a refugee village, let's say in Nea Kios, close to Stereo's house, and the one next door in another native kind of town. You find that the one who works in Athens, who comes from a refugee settlement, is much more likely to be employed in services or manufacturing. So, these investments in education go handy with what economists would coin a structural transformation, movement from the so-called traditional sector to the modern sector, manufacturing and services. And I think what is pretty cool, just to preamble some of the results that you will see in the paper at some point, is that initially they start doing labor-intensive manufacturing, and then over time they switch to capital-intensive manufacturing, and then over time they switch to service. So you see this very kind of, very prototypical kind of movement that's the ones that, you know, I talked last night about structural transformation to the students. Now, the third result, which we find very interesting, is that
was last night. No,
I was teaching last night structural transformation, I mean, a teaching mood. So, the other interesting result is to start thinking about migration. So, the evidence that we have tabulating the data, it comes very clearly, is that refugees who settled in the towns, who settled in the villages, actually are much more likely to move to Athens, Piraeus, and Salonika. And what I think is also another result for the academic literature in economics, they are way more likely to migrate abroad. Greece had this very famous program of Gastarbeiter with Germany. Actually, Germany had similar programs also with Turkey and Spain and Portugal. I'm reading more about it. It's super interesting. And you clearly see, this is like, you know, the likelihood of migration in Germany from a refugee village is twice as large as it is for a non-refugee village. And I think this is kind of compelling because those people are also not the super well-educated. So typically in economics, you would say, oh, you are a refugee if you buy the abundance hypothesis. You invest in human capital, and because you invest in human capital, you might migrate, let's say, to Athens and Salonika, or even perhaps to London. Here the story is that this happens, but at the same time, even if you don't become super well-educated, you are still more likely to search for an opportunity in Athens, Piraeus, and Salonika, or in this case, in Germany. Outside Germany, you find it, but it's not so strong. So, what are the deeper explanations? The last part we are doing in this kind of paper, and also for the paper I'll discuss shortly. We have teamed up with Metron Analysis that I'm pretty sure you
just a quick one before. So the ones who went abroad, the migrants, the refugees, were doing capital intensive or labor intensive?
This we don't observe because they were there.
Okay.
So I don't observe what they were doing there. I can observe what they do when they come back.
Okay.
This I can do.
Because then you can use it to see whether, you know, they had education, so they went to do something.
No, the education I have, and I can tell you I didn't put them here, the propensity to migrate, so this gap, applies both when you have educated, semi-educated, super-educated, which is kind of interesting for the
Kazantzidis has sung of it, the Acropolis train.
I'll come to Kazantzidis very, very short. Now, the last thing that we are doing, and this we are doing it for both kinds of projects, is that we have teamed up with Metron Analysis. I'm pretty sure that you follow every month the monthly barometer. Although now it's kind of irrelevant because you already know what we will show. But in any case, the Metron Analysis, in this monthly barometer, they have also questions that you don't read in the newspapers, which about political ideology more generally, about what people fear, how much they trust the political system, or how much they trust others. So we teamed with the team of Stratos Fanaras, and we have been doing this now for more than a year. The sample is 1,300 individuals, and Stratos Fanaras has allowed us to rotate three questions. So we are asking about the origin of respondents, whether they are refugee background or not, so that you know 35 to 38% of Greeks identify today either from the mother or the father's side as having a refugee lineage, and something like 12 to 15% respond that both their father and their mother have some connection to a refugee family. So what we are checking there, so this is actually what I mentioned before, is around 35%. Across cohorts. We also added a question, which one you believe is the most defining and important historical episode of the modern Greek state, and of course the refugees, especially those who were born in the 60s, sorry, in the 40s or the 50s, would say, look, the national catastrophe and the burning of Smyrna is the most important event, rather than the Greek Civil War or, you know, the War of Independence or anything like that. And we tend to find, and we are trying to expand the sample here in the sense that we will put it in more rounds, refugees appear today to be much more willing to take risks. So we devised that this would be like a standard risk-taking question, and this would be a question whether you are keen to migrate abroad if you were to double the income. Since there are many Greek friends here, my Turkish co-author, Şeyhun Şeykali, who is amazing, I remember calling him and says, dude, like all the Greeks, almost, you have this question, do you want to double your income and go abroad? And most of them say, we don't want to go. So this has to be placed in relative terms. So as you can see here, this is something like 37%. Two-thirds of Greeks, roughly speaking, respond that we don't want to go and live outside like you and double the income. So let me now go
10 minutes.
To culture. Now, traditionally, economists were kind of measuring culture with some question like that. So if you see a stranger, do you trust him or not? And there would be a question, oh, if I see Kevin or if I see Kostas, do I trust them differentially because of their kind of background? Now, Stelios has So when Stelios doesn't work with me, he has super good ideas, super smart. He has this top paper called Folklore, where he uses folk tales, like the one that your granny used to read to you when you were a child, and kind of extracts culture through the different stories the different societies have across the world. So the idea I had, so I do the extensions, Stelios comes with the big ideas, I do the epsilon. Why don't we take Greek literature, like Ματωμένα Χώματα, right, and try to extract the meaning of those books. Apparently this is not super well developed so far, to do machine learning on a big kind of fiction book. But we thought, okay, why don't we do it with songs, right? Because typically we'd associate Rebetiko with refugees. But we have a fantastic question today with meta-analysis, which is your favorite genre? And refugee, those who come from a refugee family are way more likely to say that Rebetiko is one of their famous, out of the more kind of popular for them kind of musics. This dude, Yannis Toudas, was like the most important person in Greek music in the 20s and 30s. He was born in Smyrna. He was the CEO, effectively the director of Odeon Records, and he was like the influential kind of person. The most important, the most popular Greek song was the Prosphigopoula, which of course discusses about Smyrna, that is portrayed to be a paradise. Coming now to Kazatzidis, you know, this is like some, you know, quotes, how he came, Kazatzidis is a second generation kind of Greek. What is kind of neat, that's why we have to use this LP, this is 1987, so Kazatzidis is already quite old. And still, he writes about the return, the road to return, about refugees who are attacked, about the return. The system is guilty. Still is, by the way. Stelios used to listen to this crappy music, apparently active member. We're also kind of identifying with a refugee kind of neighborhood origin, and still they would discuss about that. So what do we do in a nutshell? We take the universe, so 130,000 Greek songs from this database, who have the lyrics, we have who wrote the lyrics, who composed the music, and who was like the first performer. We scraped them, we had some friends and some friends of friends helping us go over the bios of thousands of artists and identify whether they're of refugees or refugee origin or not. And here you see kind of the evolution. And then we do some machine learning technique, very preliminary, so for the fancy people here, this is super easy, not something super fancy. And then we try to extract which are the predictors, which concepts predict whether the artist is refugee or native. So think about like a probit or like, you know, a linear probit. I mean, it's not linear, it's highly non-linear. Think about a probabilistic kind of model. Or if you hear a Greek song, let's say about anger, is it more likely that the artist is refugee or native? Well, if it is about anger, or it's about poverty, it's about living in favelas or being destitute, it's way more likely that the artist is a refugee. All of those are positive predictors of refugees, so some people will tell me, especially in Greece, okay, so what do the natives speak more? Love and pleasure, which of course is, as I will show you shortly, most of the Greek songs and nowadays are about love. So, let me give you some ideas. So something like 10%, 9% of Greek songs where the producers or the composers or the lyricists were kind of born in 1900, so let's say this would be songs of the 20s, were discussing about poverty. Which kind of makes sense because, you know, Greece was very poor. For the Marxists in the room, both the true and the intellectual, this is kind of a very neat result, even if you are not ideologically Marxist, you are methodologically Marxist, because it shows that as Greek GDP increases, the songs about, you know, the cultural output about poverty kind of drops. Because, you know, even those people who do not like Marx on the political side. This kind of a neat insight that what happens in economics shapes how we behave as humans in society. But again, the refugees kind of discuss a bit more about poverty, which kind of makes sense. Refugees discuss more about slums, and many of the urban refugees were living in slums in Parapimona. Over time, of course, there are no slums in Greece, so this would be actually the neo-Marxist kind of result. Well, in some sense, nobody discusses about this anymore. But now, if you were to look about songs that discuss about hardship, not about poverty, about hardship, well, refugees were discussing way more about hardship vis-a-vis natives, and this difference kind of still persists. This is the noise, we're adding more songs, hopefully we'll do better machine learning. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, this kind of also drops, but still refugee artists, although these are now third generation, perhaps even fourth generation, do discuss about hardship. This would be a share of songs mentioning wound, honors. Again, refugee artists would discuss way more about the wound. And I think this would be the most cool, thinking about injustice or more kind of political kind of songs. They would be way more likely to be produced by refugees compared to native artists. And importantly, this has persisted over time. So either you go to the second or third generation. Now, last thing, voting. Many people, historians, have written about the political preference of refugees. But most, I think it's fair to say, they are not based on data, or they were based on, you know, some visit in some archive of one electoral district. So from the League of Nations, this would be the, in our big cities like Athens, you will have the refugee neighborhood in the Ionia, the refugee neighborhood in the Erythrea, as you can see, spreads across Athens. This would be Salonika, Tumba, of course, and many other kind of places. So again, now we will do like a local analysis, but now local will mean 250 meters. So we will compare electoral preferences near PAOK's kind of stadium, which is a big experience, I strongly recommend you lifetime, to just outside and compare the political preferences over time. Now, first kind of result, 1932 elections, strong preference of refugees towards the Venizelist Party, which effectively means that they were not supporting of the Loyalist Party. Again, perhaps this is no big news, but here we can put numbers. So the gap is actually something like 15 percentage points, so far from being small. And importantly, we wanted to do 1928, but we couldn't for some data reasons. This is the time when the refugees have already started moving out from Venizelos, because they were massively dissatisfied, to put it mildly, when he did the deal with Kemal in 1931 or something, that, you know, forget compensations, there is no way that you will come back. So this was actually one of the very big shocks that happened in Greek politics. This would be the Popular Party, this could be now the Communist Party. So very early on, 10 years at least after the disaster, refugees kind of move towards the Communist Party. What is kind of interesting is that they moved to the Communist Party, although the Bolsheviks supported both militarily and financially Kemal, and the Greek Communist Party, it used to be called the Greek Socialist kind of party, if anything, was very critical of Venizelos and his imperialist kind of policies. So actually the Greek Communist Party is actually quite interesting by itself as a research topic. It was not super welcoming to the refugees in the very beginning, and actually there's a very big shift in the Communist Party during this time, actually. And then they realize that there is a lot of potential votes here, and they try to cater the message to this kind of show.
What's the discontinuity here? I don't get what's on the...
So here I go, Nea Erythrea inside the old refugee neighborhoods, and compare it to Nea Erythrea 500 meters to the non-refugee neighborhoods. The same for Panama, I do it across 80 neighborhoods. So there could be one discontinuity. So I compare preferences here, inside, to just outside. Inside to outside. This is like super zoomed, right? So the discontinuity here would be like in the terms of meters. Okay? Now, in 1932, thanks also for your question, Vasilis, it was spot on. This is kind of a sharp discontinuity. Why? Because inside the Prosfigika in Tuba, you have almost exclusively refugees, and outside, no refugees. Well, as time goes by, you know, you start having mixing, you start having like polygamic years, or you have like some form of kind of investment. So the discontinuity is when I go now to 1958, and we pick 1958 because the United Left kind does well. Well, the discontinuity is not so sharp anymore, because clearly when you go to the discontinuity in Perama between Prosfigica or in Coquignan and native places, then you start having some mix. But still, you see, for example, that ERE, in some sense, the continuation of the Royalist Party, or the right, whatever you like, call it, actually they lose something like 8 percentage points. And which is the beneficiary here? Not the center. I recall the center was running in those elections, but actually it is the United Left. Let's not enter the discussion whether this was the Communist Party in disguise or not. But clearly we see a movement towards the left, which again is considerable, is 10 percentage points, although I'm very conservative and I'm comparing places, let's say, in Asmirni within the old Prosfigica to just outside. And this kind of persistence in voting kind of continues again. One way to read it is that refugee neighborhoods are always voting against the monarchies, the royal party, ERE, Nea Demokratia, and of course they would tend to lean towards kind of the left. In 1977 they were voting for Andreas, but also for Harilos. And again, this doesn't seem to be a link towards the far right, which seems to be the movement of refugees in other kinds of settings. Here we pull all the most recent elections. Of course, the Communist Party gets something like 7% of the vote, so it's not so large. But still you observe some form of a discontinuity with the refugee neighborhoods within municipalities to lean towards the left. So, voting for the left, which goes handy, if I was to use the songs, with political kind of preferences, at least as reflected in the songs, to care about injustice, about inequality, about wound, about not so good conditions, although not poverty. Can we say something more? I must say that one great thing about Stelios is that he keeps pushing, he wants more and more, and that's why the slides are 140 pages. It's like his fault. So we are trying to do three things. And I'll just show you the last one. We are doing again this survey with metronome analysis. And we are asking questions, actually drawing on a lot of research. I think Konstantinos Matakos does some really kind of work, which is based on the political preferences. So we have questions. First of all, this is a question of metronome analysis, quite interesting. I have been telling my political friends to look at it. So they have a question whether you feel excluded from the society or not, which is not reported in Mega Channel or Catherine Levy. So refugees, so again, today we're like third generation or fourth generation refugees, they would be more likely to say that they are feeling excluded from the society. They will be way more distrustful to the political system. This would be the standard European social survey kind of question. And what I think is the most neat result is that there is this question that is very popular in the US, even now with the elections. Oh, do you want a big state, and do you want the state to redistribute kind of wealth, or you are way more individualistic? Again, a caveat is that in Greece, most people, there are very few very individualistic people like it is in the US. But refugees are way more likely to respond, refugees here, third or fourth generation, that we want more distribution and more support. And what is neat, and you will see this in the paper when we release it, is that even if you look at the voters of, let's say, Nea Demokratia, and we do also like the further to the right kind of parties, still they will say, so they will be like within, let's say, the dominant party in Greece, now they will be the ones who would want even more kind of redistribution. Which kind now, if I was to put everything together and conclude, what we're trying to do here is that we're trying to do a thorough, kind of holistic assessment of the influx of 1.4, 1.5 million refugees, something like 100 years ago, perhaps 110, looking both at economics, cultural production, and politics, and of course all these three are not isolated, they kind of interact and intersect. And at the same time, we want to provide data, big data, that many researchers and the Greek people can use in research. You can go here. You can even have the family name of your grandfather or your great-grandfather, and you know, you can trace where he came, where he went, and we will be adding more and more data. Thank you so much, Vasily. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for managing the time, going through all this material. This is very impressive, of course, and a humongous amount of work. I will open it to the audience for questions, comments, further exploration, but things you may want to ask. Let's take a question there. Then.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. I'm more interested in the political approach, and you did that at the end, but you focus mostly the internal political situation of Greece. From an international perspective, what I wanted to say is it seems that it's an acceptable event or something like that, but basically the Paris Peace Conference, when it began in January 1919 and carried on into 1920, and we had the various treaties that emanated from that, basically all it was for the two main imperialist powers at the time, France and Britain, it was a carve-up for their own interest, basically. So, and once they realized, perhaps in their mind, they got it wrong because it did not satisfy the needs of modern Turkey, and because they were in fear of what might happen with the emergent so-called Soviet Union. So then we had 1923 when the Greek forces were defeated. Then we had 1923 in the Treaty of Lausanne. And basically, it was a sellout. The Greeks were basically left in the lurch, and they ended up, as you said, about 1.5 million refugees. And they basically, I just want to say, they used Greece, for example, and the Ukrainian campaign, about two divisions of Greek military, about 20,000, were sent there to fight in support of General Anton Deniki, the commander-in-chief of the White Army. So basically, they used them. So basically, the main imperialist powers just used whatever events to suit their own interest. I'll stop anyway.
Fine, I agree with that. There's no question on anything. Again, we take as given the historical episode. It's outside my discipline, I think, to understand the mistakes of Greeks or others. Given the influx, I think we should focus on the positive here, that at least our research shows, and accords, I think, with the more anecdotal kind of evidence, that this has been a massive success of the integration of those refugees. Let me remind something that you saw, that something like 10 years, so we're like in the early 30s or the mid-30s, and we see refugee villages acquiring, you know, primary education in a movement towards the modern sector. Manolo, please.
Can we take Lila's question first?
Never mind. Anyway, well, congratulations for such a rich and diverse talk. The thing is that hundreds of Greeks are studying the refugees of Asia Minor. You know, I'm one of them. I'm Lila Leontidou. I wrote Policy COB. I can give you that book. In any case, since it is such a rich presentation, everybody's discussion about certain issues like Rebetika or the towns and the cities and so on would be a footnote to your book. Like, I mean, it's I was really impressed with your scope, especially the issue of migration from Greece abroad by refugees and natives, especially the schooling aspects, which, I mean, some are really innovative. Some of them we have not studied. And studying the issue of land, you said that land was allocated to peasants rather than urban residents. This is, you have, I think, to rethink about it, because urban residents were allocated land by the Refugee Settlement Commission with concern to site and services, construction of housing. They gave them the sites and the services, and the refugees would construct their houses if they were among the richer refugees who came with some money with them. In any case, this land was given to them. And the other thing is that poor refugees would squat on land, and therefore those, you know, squatting, big squatting communities were started during the refugee inflow, and they continued to flourish, and flourish, quote unquote, you know, in Greece. That is one thing that I would like you to rethink if you think. The other thing is that the refugees in manufacturing and women as a group of, you know, qualified workers, the tapestry industry, and the, all these. This is the second one. The third one, which I think you touch upon, and please go on touching upon it and researching it, is about the Muslims. Where the Muslims, I was asked by Turkish colleagues and so on about the Muslims who left Greece and what happened to them in Turkey. And I said, I have heard nothing about this. And you had a whole map. I was really excited with your maps, by the way. So thank you very much. That's the end of my intervention.
Lila, thanks, Victor. You should give me your book. One big remark, let me stress it for once more. This aims to be complementary to work that you have done or others have done, which is more anecdotal, based on sound historical research or political science. We will make all data available so people can explore various other interesting angles that I can tell you, given after 7 years of work and managing this big team, you know, it's, we are reaching our capacity, mental capacity, which is not very high to start with. Now, on women, we have a lot of results that I didn't present here. You are spot on that most refugees were women. And actually, if anything, women benefit way more after taking into account the harmful kind of experience. So women is something we have explored. We have data, we are focusing on the Greek side of the population exchange. Mm-hmm. We can explore more the issue of the land that the Muslims abandoned. This actually we have data, so Manoli, we have this is also the 1920 census, and then we have, you know, refugee kind of, sorry, Muslim kind of settlements. The issue of what refugees from Greece to Turkey did is something quite different. You know, my Turkish co-author has some ideas. Let me say, however, that this was a smaller component because of the size of Turkey. Although, let me say something which is fundamental, also relates to your remark. You have a lot of population movement from Bulgaria, from Romania, from Yugoslavia, or whatever it was called at the time. So you have like a lot, as you pointed out, you know, from Ukraine. So there's like a lot of population movement, which is fascinating, and perhaps one could apply this kind of thing. Please. Whatever it is.
So I have a question. There is one dimension that seems a little puzzling to me. When you looked at the educational attainment of people of refugee origin, it starts a bit below the natives and catches up and even overtakes them, which suggests relatively quick convergence with the native, and that's also reflected perhaps in that they stop singing about poverty. Now, on the other hand, there's other dimensions which seem to keep this, I guess, underdog perhaps mentality, whether in the songs singing about exclusion or whether in this survey reporting that they are at a larger extent that they're outside the system. So I was wondering if you have any ideas about, you know, is this conflicting? Is there a conflict there in this observation, or do you have an explanation for this? Or is this a sort of an identity which now, you know, this underdog identity which is divorced from access to society as we would measure it materially by income or education, but still persists as part of, you know, who we are independently of actual outcomes.
So great, spot on comments. So one aspect that we have not thought much, I have to be sincere here, is the more conceptual kind of side. On the structural transformation, it's a clear, because actually economics has a clear kind of framework. We are thinking more about identity. So my story, I think our story, is kind of the following. You have an adverse shock. This adverse shock affects economics and, let's say, how ideology slash cultural beliefs. In economics, there is very fast convergence, and if anything, overtake. Now, the identity, I think, is maintained. So I want to think about this underdog mentality, or the feel that I'm excluded from the society, or I'm distrustful to societal kind of institutions, as something that if I could measure it at the time, it would be there. And regarding the result, actually, perhaps I made too much joke, I think the result that Greek songs used to be a lot about poverty, living in favelas, which the refugees lived more, but also natives, and over time this declines, while at the same time Greece takes off, I think it's a very neat result for culture and economics, and it has clearly a Hegelian, if you prefer, not a Marxist element, that look, something that happens in economics kind of shapes, you know, how we produce culture in this case. But I want to think more perhaps your ideas later, but I think identity score, John Mokyr, I presented at Northwestern last year, he was mentioning an analogy with some Jewish clans in New York, and making, you know, Jolly so funny and so interesting. He was making the point that you go to some of Jewish origin New Yorker, you go to his house, a 50 million kind of house, and 10 minutes down the road, he will go and put some music that is very depressing, and he will start crying about his bad luck. I wouldn't go that full that way, but I think there is kind of this component still present. What I can tell you, as half joke, half reality, if you were to go to the new stadium of AEK, it strongly has this flavor. So the gates, you know, have the name Cappadocia, Smyr. If you go to the suites, which is not, I guess, for the poor, they have those big pictures, refugees attacked, we will always be here for you, etc., etc. So I think Greeks of that background are trying to maintain this identity. It's a good theory question, why you want to do that.
Can I just say something before we go to Alex?
Just can I make a comment about your point, Ilias? It's also, Dinas has a paper with the, you know, refugees, incoming refugees from the Syria. Ilias Dinas has a paper on the how they, refugees, migrants from the Asia Minor, how they welcomed from the refugees in the...
I don't think so.
The empathy one.
For these refugees?
Yeah.
Yes, for the empathy paper, there is. Ilasinas.
Dinas and Fuka.
Fuka, yeah.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's what she means.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's...
They go only, so they have like some results, actually very similar to what actually we replicate kind of the result, with what is the most important historical event in Greek history, and they actually were using their exact kind of question, which they interpret as identity.
Okay.
So their paper kind of, I don't know what they call it, empathy or not, but you know, they call it that, it's an interesting result, in some sense it's kind of the starting point. It goes back to Manoli's point. Look, today, Greeks identify with their ancestors that came to us.
Very strongly.
Yes. Just a very quick one. We'll follow up later on the rest. You mentioned that they're catching up quite quickly in terms of incomes, but are you able to check about wealth?
No. The only thing I can say, let me be accurate, they catch up in terms of education. And also structural transformation, clearly wages in manufacturing and services are over time high. Wealth you cannot, or income, you know, it's not recorded. And so that you know, Stelios has been a typical Skype call between Stelios and when Stratos and the team of Metro Analysis comes, is that, oh, we really want to ask something about income. So that, you know, all the pollsters in Greece, nobody asks income.
No,
it's like a no-go, because the minute they ask something about income, they hang up the phone because they think that they're like hidden tax collectors. So even on that, we try to do something like that. They told us it's like a no-go.
I think an aspect on this issue about identity, economic convergence, and then the political, is also that you can have very easily, I think, you know, for migrants and kind of migrant communities in general, not only refugees, like you can have economic convergence, so you catch up, you know, your kids catch up in educational levels, maybe surpass the local population, and kind of converge economically, but politically you're not included. You're not included in either, you know, the political party representation or in lower level political institutions because you're not part of this kind of native community. And I think for the refugees, at least talking about sort of the population from Pontus, there's definitely that, anecdotally, you know, a very strong sense of that. You know, you don't have the, you know, the representation of those people, even if they reach their own, you know, a level of elite within the group, they cannot enter into the mainstream elite.
I think it's a spot on comment. Let me say two results I didn't show. So, Stelios had this very interesting idea, and Vasilis Logothetis, I didn't even know that they are still around. So we managed to get information of all the festivals of youth organizations of parties. So for the younger people in the room, the Communist Party, you know, had like the best kind of festival, even if you were like a far rider, you would go there for the party. And apparently they are still happening. And what we have in some part of the paper is that the Communist Party, the likelihood to invite an artist of a refugee origin is twice as large as compared to the youth organizations of PASOK or them. And what we are trying to do now is get the lists of candidates. We have them after 1975, do a similarity analysis of the names, so whether they are refugee or not. And then what we believe is happening is that the Communist Party is really smart in trying to have more kind of representatives from this kind of group, which will go in your kind of line.
Yeah. That could also be demand and supply thing in both ways. But
very quickly, building on Vasili's point, in Greek politics, you know, over decades, you had the declaration of political leanings that could act and serve as a key both into entry into politics, but also into economic activity. Like, you know, a lot of people were disqualified or excluded from the public sector and public service because of the declaration of political leanings. And given that refugees had a more left-leaning political views, that they were excluded from certain jobs or from society or from certain aspects of society very early on, which can translate into what you see today.
That is, going back to your comment before, one reason why I want to get done with this is because this is where I want to go. Like the Greek Civil War with big data and this period of Kachektikis Demokratias. It's super interesting.
Okay, Alex is waiting to ask his question.
Yeah, so a couple of points. I mean, you mentioned that it was a very successful integration as a result. So, A, what can we learn from that? And B, can we replicate similar conditions given the current Greece's environment of refugees coming with distinctively different backgrounds, distinctively different origins and conditions? I mean, is there anything that Greece could potentially learn from this experience, or is it the cultural differences are too big?
Strictly speaking, from a scientific viewpoint, I would say I have a political preference for something, but it's irrelevant to what we're discussing. I'm just saying that I think the data speak, and I think this is useful, actually going to your very nice remark. I think the reason why we need big data, like, you know, covering all of Greece ideally, is that the data suggests that this integration was successful. Obviously, one could not. It's a typical external validity argument. And clearly, those individuals had like clearly same religion, clearly same language, some perhaps exception, although the dialect was very heavy. Even when I say they had like the reading the newspapers at the time, especially the anti-Venizelis, it's not that they were particularly welcome to the refugee. But I think it's, you cannot say more about it. Please.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
there's
one question.
Yeah. So on the politics side, is there anything that you can say about replicating the uprootedness sort of question. So yes, they identify more or less, but conditionally on that, do they participate more or less? Do they say sort of, yes, I care about inequalities, but because I might leave, I don't care about it. I will vote left, but I do not go vote. Or is there a differential on how they behave based on these outcomes, conditional on what they're voting for? Because it would be very neat if you could show that they're more willing to leave, and therefore, conditional on their preferences, they're less willing to vote, and they're less willing to.
So we have not played with political, but with vote, with whether you participate in the election or not. I think this is a question that Metron collects, but it's one of the standard questions that perhaps we can play with that. I want to use your question to stress here, in my personal view, and I think Stelios is the same here, it's not perhaps so interesting the voting result, but this comes with a distinct kind of ideology, perceptions, and beliefs. And I think it's way more important than saying, oh, you're voting X versus Y. And this goes back to Manolis' point. I think it reflects to a great extent an identity that we care about refugees, that we care about others, that we care about inequality and injustice. At least this is what they respond.
But maybe not.
And what the song say
will also be: I care about this, but I'm also a bit detached from society. Therefore, I can migrate to other places.
Yeah, we can look clearly. They migrate to other places.
After congratulating you for the research, I would like to comment that the refugees were somehow denied the opportunity to play the central political scene. If one sees and measures the prime minister, I mean, if you just imagine they were coming from southern Greece and from the islands, it was from Peloponnese mainly, the Papandreou dynasty, Canelopoulos, Samaras, whatever, and from the islands, Mitsotakis dynasty, and so on. Androulakis, Kazelakis, and all the Akis. Bugarakis, all the Akis. So it was from the islands and from Peloponnese. You won't see a political leader, none that I know of. Or Ivis. No Ivis, no Ogan. This is not a coincidence. So it is structural, and this doesn't really have to do with what somebody asked before, because there are wealthy.
Yeah, the data clearly show that they
became industrialists and so on. But they couldn't enter the central political scene there as a refugee. But still, today, that we have forgotten, I mean, I don't know what Ivis or Ogis may mean. But these rigidities are still holding the
country.
Excellent
point. What I can tell you also related to Vasilis' earlier remark. As we speak, we have like this thing that helped us in AU in the Peloponnese with the origin of refugee artists. We are doing it with the Politburo and the General Committee, Kypriot European Politburo, and the Communist Party. Zachariadis, actually, the Communist Party, and when they make this big swing, out of 9 or out of 7, they have 4 or 5 refugees.
Yes.
I see
that.
No, which I think is kind of and also what is the name that Khomeini wrote the book Nikki. This guy was also a refugee. Khomeini was also a leader of a party. He's Christos' grandfather.
Nefeloudis.
No, but also it's a different name.
Nefeloudis.
He was also a refugee. So I think it kind of slightly fits. We want to explore it more. You are right on the top. I hadn't think about it. We're thinking about, you know, getting information on the names on the ballot and CMPs. I think again, this I can say also with some preliminary evidence we have is that the Communist Party or EDA were kind of smart. Perhaps, you know, being responding to the demand. And what you are spot on and going also to your point is that this question that Metron has about society is a castle, it's like melodramatically specified whether you feel inside the castle or outside, still today despite economic convergence and educational, they are way more likely to respond.
Because it's
another manifestation.
Okay, we're going to close with a question by Kevin.
Oh, you make it sound like a ritual.
It's a good ritual.
I wanted to reinforce the point about what is culturally specific here, or putting it in other terms, where are the surprises? If you want to think comparatively, then I've got a number of these features are not that unusual. If we think of the Irish going to the United States, okay, we can't find easy direct comparisons, but what are the closest comparisons? Studies of the Irish in the United States, I think, would show some similar characteristics, similar political attitudes, far more integrated with the Democratic Party than the Republicans, Kennedy, etc. Far more people in the United States who claim to have Irish descent than could possibly have come from a geographical area normally regarded as foreign. So a number of these points about identity and a sense of exclusion or more radical attitudes, that's maybe putting it too strongly, but a sense of detachment would, I think, often arise in the case of large-scale migration, creating ghettos. If you think of Chicago and Mayor Daley as a city boss, he was a city boss appealing to minorities of migrants, e.g. from Ireland, creating a reciprocal relationship in terms of patronage and clientelism. So some of these points, I think, could make nice comparisons with a wider migration literature. Many surprises, perhaps, in Hellenic studies. Comparatively, it could perhaps be reinforced by similarities.
Kevin, spot on, great point. I went very quickly over two slides on literature.
Oh, sorry.
Actually, it's a very good analogy, the US. I think that the message that we have some studies other than the Jewish history, even this is kind of debated, on the uprootedness. So I think this is a clear-cut result that the Greek experience adds to kind of a bigger literature, which I think is actually quite important. Stelios and I like a lot the methodological innovation to use songs to measure culture, which I think as people become better with machine learning, and you know, this is potentially something neat here. I hadn't thought about the US case. Bustan and Abramisky are working on this thing in economics. I think it's a very interesting analogy.
Can I say another analogy that could perhaps be significant is with the Armenian community because of the question of the genocide, and that touches upon the identity and the closeness of even third generation of refugees with the land. The lost land, let's say.
Okay, last comment.
So, especially one important aspect, especially with migration, is whether the immigrants come in contiguous areas, right, on the map. So, basically, are they spread out or do they remain close to each other? Because if they remain close to each other, a lot of the effects you have here are kind of confounded by the societal aspect, and you can measure it, right?
And we do.
Yeah.
I went very quickly on heterogeneity.
Yeah.
We have two sorts of heterogeneity.
The spatial heterogeneity.
Spatial heterogeneity.
Yeah.
Actually, what we were checking is whether, I think I had Kiziki, right, where people went to many places. So we check whether this kind of a network, because now you have been displaced from one place, you go, let's say, to village X, but then other people from this, from the place of origin kind of spread. And we do find that the structural transformation in manufacturing services is kind of stronger.
Especially in education, what happens is that if you have like schools who are predominantly have students from kind of immigrant families, then you will observe very similar pathways.
They're super interesting.
Exactly.
This we will not be able to observe. What I hope at some point in a couple of years to be able to achieve is digitize find the schools of the Venizelist 1929?
Kind of a proxy to all this might be, so basically what happened is that when the immigrants were coming, especially in rural areas, they were establishing churches. So basically, if you see like the dates of the establishment of churches, you can find like communities in this way as a proxy.
And
it's very difficult data to get your hands on. You have to speak to the Greek church, which can get complicated. But if you get your hands on...
I work in a business school. They are a very successful business.
Okay, let's finish on this very nice note. Please join me in thanking Leo.